Welcome to Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect.
Hello, and welcome to Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect. My name is Julia Gockenbach, and I am excited to be here with our guest, Tammy Zonker. Tammy, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm delighted to be here, Julia. Thanks for inviting me.
We're so excited to have Tammy with us today. Before we get into our conversation, I want to share a little bit about you. Tammy is an internationally recognized fundraising strategist and major gifts expert who has helped raise nearly $1 billion in her 30-year career, including a record $27.1 million gift. She is the founder of Fundraising Transformed, host of the Intentional Fundraiser podcast, and serves as the president of the Modern Institute for Charitable Giving. Tammy trains and speaks globally, equipping fundraisers to build transformational donor relationships. Tammy, you have had a remarkable career in fundraising. That was just four lines about 30 years of fundraising. So we know you have so much more to share with us today. Can you tell us first, though, before we get into all that, what drew you to this work originally? How do you find yourself here today?
Amazing. What a journey in 30 years. I mean, it feels like it was just yesterday. But I actually started my career in IT consulting. I spent almost 15 years helping organizations provide, you know, do technology solutions for national organizations. And so as a practice director for that employer, they put all of their people through the Stephen Covey 7 Habits of Highly Effective People 5-day course. And there was no such thing as a virtual course back then. So this was like, go to a place, park in the parking lot, you know, go through the course. And I remember distinctly the last day. The first exercise of that day was asking all of us to visualize our 80th birthday party. And so we were visualizing like who was in the room and essentially what were they acknowledging us for? What did our life's work, how did it impact people? What did people have to say about it? So essentially the legacy question. And I realized in that exercise that other than my faith and my family, that what I loved the most about my life was the volunteer work that I did with women and children's causes. And so that was a light bulb moment. I'm like, oh, well, that's what I should be doing. And so I went back to the Indiana University School of Philanthropy, the fundraising school, and begun my career like, okay, how do I transition from for-profit consulting into fundraising? So that's how I got here. And I've never, ever regretted that.
Wow. That is a very interesting like segue into fundraising to think who's going to be at my 80th birthday party and what are they going to say? And we have a million things we could talk about, but this podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about major gifts. And I would be interested to know if you've ever asked any of your donors that question about their 80th birthday and how has that affected their giving?
Yeah. I mean, I think, first of all, I like to ask that question long before they're 80.
Good point. Good point.
Yes. Just to clarify. And I do ask that question and have asked that question. And it's, just like for me, they have their own kind of epiphany. And what I've often been surprised by is what they say versus what I thought they might say. You know, we as fundraisers, we do a lot of due diligence. We know what organizations typically these are our prospective donors or even our loyal donors. We know a little bit about what they give to other organizations. And so sometimes we kind of piece those together and make some assumptions about what they'll say about their legacy or what they want to accomplish or how they picture their 80th birthday. And so often we're wrong. And they illuminate something amazing that is like takes our understanding of them and our respect for them to the next level.
And I know we're going to talk about that a little bit more too. It's very cool to see though how your story has shaped how you talk to donors, and I'm interested to learn more about that. Before we get into some of this strategy and best practice, is there a story from early in your career similar to this one about the 80th birthday party that was an interaction maybe with a donor that affected how you talk to donors now or how you approach donors?
Yes. I mean, so much of what I have learned about major gift fundraising is from mistakes I made.
Samesies.
So this was my very, very first fundraising job. This was a Girl Scout council in Northeastern Indiana that took a chance on me, you know, this like fundraising or this IT consulting person who wanted to make this leap. And so my very first job was DD of the Girl Scouts for Limberlost Council. And they're still like doing amazing work. And I remember sitting down with our very top donor. I'll call him John. So I sat down with John and just naively, I said, John, it must be incredible being in a position where you can give to so many causes in such an incredible way and to make such a huge difference. And he looked at me. He actually had those like half reader, half lens readers. And he tilted his head down and he looked at me over his readers. And he said, Tammy, some days it feels more like a burden than a joy, because I have to say no way more than I can say yes. And that was a huge moment for me, realizing that I did make an assumption. You know, I am sitting here with a completely different paradigm, looking at him as someone that I see as like uber wealthy, very charitable, and I just guessed that must just be amazing. And I'm sure it is on some days, but there's also, I didn't think about the shadow side of that. And so again, the big lesson out of that was, don't make assumptions, ask questions, be curious. And I think curiosity is one of the most important traits, definitely in the top three important traits of any great fundraiser. So our job is to really ask questions and to explore why they give, what's the best way, best gift they've ever given, or the best impact, or the most meaningful way they've ever been acknowledged for their giving. And again, don't make assumptions, ask questions, ask follow-on questions, and be curious, don't make assumptions.
That is perfect. Even those three questions that you just shared, I feel like would unlock so much about a donor. What's your favorite way to have been acknowledged? What's the biggest impact you've made? Things like that would share so much about their heart and help you get to know them. You know, we talk a lot about the importance of relationship, and those questions are really helpful ways to get to know anybody, but especially someone that you're working with, to make an impact. That's great. Well, I appreciate you sharing that story, and I'm already so inspired, and so I'm really looking forward to learning more from you today. I know that you're going to have a lot of encouragement, and I'm just excited on behalf of our listeners and on behalf of myself, because I'm just excited to learn from you today. So let's dive into some of the best practices and strategies that go along with major gift fundraising. My first question is, what do you think are the most common misconceptions that nonprofit leaders have about major donors? I think, like you said, you sat down with this donor and made a statement. I think a lot of us tend to do that. So what are some other misunderstandings we may have about that person sitting across the table from us?
Yeah. You know, I think the first misconception I think that a lot of nonprofits have, especially mid-sized nonprofits or small nonprofits, or really any nonprofit that doesn't have a robust, high functioning major gifts program, is that so often we believe that those major donors are out there. Like, we need to go find those major donors. Or we think, oh, I mean, when I first got started in fundraising, it was like, Oprah, we just need Oprah. And of course, the modern day Oprah, although she's still very generous, We think Mackenzie Scott. How do we get on Mackenzie Scott's radar? Or, you know, I'm based in Detroit, and so in Detroit, it's Dan Gilbert. You know, he owns the Rocket Companies, Rocket Mortgage. He owns the Cleveland Cavaliers. I mean, he's just an incredible philanthropist, and you know, one a billionaire. So we just need Dan Gilbert. But the truth is, most organizations, your major donors are hiding in your database right now. If you really looked at your data, if you logged into Donor Perfect, you logged into your CRM, and you started really looking at the data, you would see that you have donors right now who have the capacity to give you a major gift. But equally important, if not more important, is that they have already demonstrated their propensity to be charitable. They've already given to you. So that's like, they have the capacity. They are charitable, because there are a lot of people who have really massive wealth who aren't charitable at all. So they have the capacity, they're charitable, and they've already raised their hand and say, hey, I like your work. I've already given to you. So they've got that trifecta, the capacity, the propensity to give, and of course, the affinity for your cause. So the first thing is, the grass is not always greener on the other side. You have a lot of wonderful resources or potential major donors in your database right now. So let's find them. Let's start there. So I think that's probably the biggest misconception that I encounter. The second misconception that I encounter is, when people think about major gift fundraising, they think it's all about asking. And Julia, you know, it's not about asking at all. It really is about relationships, right? And relationships are built on shared values, or at least some shared values, not 100%, but shared values or common ground. And those relationships are built on trust. Even if we look at the relationships in our own lives, it's all about beliefs and values and trust. And so it's not about asking. And so often we approach it like it is about asking. So think about even some of us who have reached out to our board members and saying, we need help in developing our major gifts program. Who would be willing to help? Who knows someone? And you hear crickets.
I laugh because I've been there. Yeah, I've been in those meetings.
You hear crickets and you're like, oh, I don't know anyone. Well, of course they don't know anyone if it's really all about asking. But a better way to say it or to ask the question is, who would be willing to help us build and develop more meaningful relationships? I mean, people build relationships day in and day out in their lives. Of course they can help do that. In fact, if you really look at the, you know, kind of that five-step donor engagement process, the asking and the recognition is maybe 10% tops. The rest of it, the discovery, the cultivation, the stewardship, that's 90% of what major gift development is really all about. And so that's the second misconception, I think, is that it's all about asking, when it's just a tiny bit about asking, and it's way more about relationships and coming together for a shared vision and, you know, what people want to see happen in your community through you, through your work.
Well, and I want to talk a lot more about the relationships, because those are an important part, like you said, of building trust. And I think sometimes, especially people who come into an organization the organization is maybe already established, trying to figure out how to build trust with donors who were established with a past development director or a past executive director. How can someone build that relationship? Let's use your $27.1 million gift and talk a little bit about what the ingredients are to make something like that possible relationally, not just practically or tactically, but relationally. How did you get to that point?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're coming into an organization, like you're new, Or if you are, maybe you have been with the organization, but you've been promoted or you've moved from annual fund, and maybe you've transitioned into managing a portfolio of donors. So the first thing is, you do want to establish that trust and you want to establish that relationship. And sometimes, no matter how wonderful you are, and no matter how lovely and delightful you are in that voicemail or that email that you send trying to set up that first meeting, again, you don't get a response. I mean, people are busy, and you just sound kind of like the friendly stranger from the nonprofit that I support or that I care about. And so the first thing is, I always say peer-to-peer relationships. So if you can have someone that they have an existing relationship with, whether that's a board member or maybe it's the executive director or CEO, maybe it is another donor, maybe they're a member of a certain giving, community, a giving circle, and they can kind of make that warm introduction. Tammy's new, she's just come on as in this role, and I got to tell you, she's really amazing. Or I've never met anyone so committed to this cause, and I would like to actually just set up a little coffee visit and introduce you. They don't have to say, "I know, I hear you've been like ghosting Tammy." No shame. So I just really think that you would enjoy meeting, and I'd like to help facilitate that. The other little nuance that I said in that example was, I'd like to set up a visit. If we're really looking to build relationships, I'm not sure that the meeting is the warmest way to invite that gathering, that meeting. And I prefer to call them visits. I mean, think about other relationships that you have and see if there's some correlation. So, for example, I always give the example of my grandmother. Like, if I were going to want to sit down with my grandmother, I wouldn't call and say, "Grandma, it's Tammy. I wanted to set up a meeting with you. It's been way too long." I would say, "Grandma, it's Tammy. I miss you." Or, "It's been too long since we've talked, and I would love to schedule a visit. I know you're always out and about. What might work for you? Do you have your calendar handy?" So again, just being more familial. I think meeting is kind of is more of a transactional language. So I just want us to kind of watch the language. So that's my answer to like part one of your question. If you can have that peer introduction, if you can set up visits instead of meetings, if this is a very formal corporate meeting, I would call it a meeting. But if it's you're trying to schedule time with an individual, I would call it a visit. And be clear about the purpose of the visit and how long you're asking them to give you. Again, want to have a visit? Do you have 30 minutes? And can we do it sometime in the next 2 weeks? What might work for you? Now, that's part one. The other part of that question was related to the $27.1 million gift. And, there were like, what were the ingredients that really made that gift come to life? So, first was a really inspiring, courageous vision, like something that inspired people to want to be a part of it. So, in this particular example, this is the story from the gift from General Motors Foundation to the United Way for Southeastern Michigan. And this gift was actually cultivated while General Motors was in bankruptcy. So this was 2010, 2012. The economy, we were in a huge recession nationwide, and I would argue that no one was hit harder than Detroit. Two of the three biggest employers, the automakers, were in bankruptcy, General Motors and Chrysler. The unemployment rate was about 30%. In the city of Detroit, one in five homes were in foreclosure. The city itself was $18 billion in debt. So it was really tough times, and our population plummeted. People, they lost their jobs, they walked away from their mortgages, they were just leaving to go find meaningful employment so they could take care of their families. And so the United Way and their board, their CEO, Michael Brennan, just had this big, Jim Collins, good to great, big, hairy, audacious vision. And that was to make Detroit a top five city to live and work by the year 2030. And I mean, in the face of those stats that I gave you, you can see how like big, hairy, and truly audacious that statement is. And so, but there was some, you know, the courage to say it out loud, the courage to do some pilot work, and the generosity of some foundations, Kresge and Skillman Foundation and AT&T and some other real leaders, to help do some pilots around high school turnaround, because Detroit Public Schools were graduating about 30% of their students at that point in time. A lot of challenges. Early childhood development, kids were showing up to kindergarten, not meeting, you know, ready to learn standards. There was a food shortage, not a single grocery store in the city of Detroit. And a lot of the families that were living, the native Detroiters, were unbanked. Again, as a result of distrust, institutional racism, generational poverty, like this, all these legacy issues, folks didn't put their money in the bank. They would cash their checks either at advance, payday advances, or cash them at the local gas station or liquor store. Now, let me just say, I love Detroit. Detroit has made a huge turnaround, a comeback, a renaissance, and you should come to Detroit. But at the time, it was really, really hard. And so this courageous vision from the CEO and the board was truly inspirational. So a courageous, inspiring vision was the number one ingredient. The number two ingredient, and these are not in a stacked ranking, right? This is like the trifecta of these things. The third was peer-to-peer relationships. So it wasn't me, the senior director of corporate engagement, calling up the North American president of General Motors. It was leveraging one of our volunteers. He was both a board member, he was also chair of the campaign cabinet for the United Way annual fund campaign. His name is Jeff Bergeron, and he is now retired, but he was the practicing director of Ernst & Young. Just an incredible human. And of course, he had a relationship with Mark Royce, the North American president of GM. He set up the appointment. He called. He said, "You know, I'm on the board. I'm on the cabinet. GM's been a great partner for many years with the United Way, and you've run these workforce campaigns. We just want to come in and talk about what we're doing now and learn more about what you're doing, especially in these trying times." And so he set up the visit. And so it was he came on the visit along with Mike Brennan, our CEO, and then I came along as the fundraiser, if you will. And so we sat down, and niceties were exchanged, of course. And then he said, "Listen, we're going to do our best to run a United Way campaign with our employees right now, but we just laid off like 10,000 people. So I don't know how it's going to go. The people who are remaining are nervous. So we'll do our best. And we're not in a position to give a corporate gift this year. Is anything else?" I mean, he was very kind, amazing, but he had a lot of work to do. And so we said, "Well, thank you. Thanks for what you have done all these many years. Thanks also for being willing to run a campaign in these trying times. But we're not here to talk about the campaign. We're here to talk about the future. And we're here to talk about our vision on how we, with support of this community, can make Detroit a top five city to live and work by the year 2030. And we talked through each of those strategies. So it was the peer-to-peer engagement and the courageous vision, and then a compelling story well told. In that, the one ask coming out of that meeting was not for a gift. It was to come to our offices for a tour, a tour of how this turnaround work was going to happen. Now, you have to know we had a pretty boring office, like a lot of nonprofits, right? The work happens out there in the community. But we had some, you know, we had our war room with our, the initiatives and the you know, the flip chart paper, where were we green, like on track, where were we yellow and at risk, and where were we red, like fail, what were our problems, where were we failing in this turnaround work. And we walked him through all of that. He sat in on a 2-1-1, a help, you know, where folks call in and ask for basic needs assistance, signed a non-disclosure, listened in on a call, and really got present to that immersive experience. And then we talked about the work. And what was interesting is the more that we talked about our failings, the more we talked about what wasn't working and our vulnerabilities, the more transparent he became and talked about their vulnerabilities. And he said, you know, we've lost our soul. We've forgotten who we are at General Motors because of this bankruptcy, because of these, you know, these very difficult times. But we are going to come back. We are going to make this up to our employees, to the city of Detroit, to the nation. So the one ask coming out of that meeting was not for money. The one ask was, come to one of our turnaround schools where we're having success, where we're on track to graduate 80% or more of these youth, where we have an early learning community, where those children, those families, those, that network of family, friends, and neighbors who are doing caregiving during the day while mom and or dad work are getting support. And so he said, okay, I'll come on that tour, but I'd like to see a proposal for what would it take to turn around 5 more schools, because we had shared the results or the progression of the 5 pilot schools. And so, of course, we're telling stories and these listening in on that call, coming to the school. And frankly, the coming to the school was an immersive story experience as well. He walked through the same metal detectors that every student walks through in the morning. He sat down in a library with us that had scarcely any books. We talked with the principals and they talked about why they do this work, why they give their students their cell phone numbers. And they're like, you call or text anytime, any hour, any day of the week. You're not at school today. Where are you? What's going on? And then we had some students tell their stories, inspiring stories, courageous stories, like such tenacity, such resilience, and such commitment to being like the first person in their family. I mean, very strength-based, ethical storytelling that let them tell their story how they wanted to tell it, from a place of strength and aspiration. And so then principals left and the students left, and it was just us, meaning Jeff Bergeron, the peer, the volunteer, Michael Brennan, the head of our, the VP of the educational turnaround work, myself. And we walked through the proposal. I had a chance to walk through the proposal line by line by line. And then Mike Brennan, the CEO, asked, he said, we're asking you to make an investment of $27.1 million in our work. And then there was silence. And then Mark said, yes, let's do this. I don't know how we're going to do it, but let's do this. And then there was more silence because we had forgotten to rehearse what to say if he said yes. And so I said, thank you. Like, this is a day we'll never forget. So it was the inspiring vision. It was the peer-to-peer relationships, and it was the story well told, and not just told, but lived. You know, that immersive experience. So that was a bit of a, maybe a longer story. I never know how to tell that story in a short way.
No, there's so much in there that is valuable, and like, you could replicate that in many organizations, whether big or small. Invite someone to your office, invite someone to your site, whether you're looking for a $27.1 million gift or a $2,000 gift. It's that translates in many ways. And my favorite part of this story is that in your first meeting, they said no. I love that. That they said, we can't give a corporate gift this year. And even knowing that, you all still invited them to see what you were doing. And I think the key is what you said, that you weren't worried about the gift, you were worried about the future. And so it didn't matter that they said no, because later on maybe they could say yes. And I think that's really inspiring how you left the door open for them, not only to see the transformation that was happening through your organization, but also to be part of it. That is just so cool.
It's a great insight, Julia. And I never really thought about it quite in that way, but it would have been easy to say, oh, well, thank you again, and yeah, we'll be back when you're out of bankruptcy.
So true.
Which is so transactional.
Exactly. You were looking for a relationship, not a gift, which is the whole crux of this conversation. And I think that's really, like what you said about the future is so powerful, because I think as fundraisers, sometimes we're just concerned about this current program, or this the end of year is coming and we're in the red or whatever, but there are relationships to be built for long term, and the way you do that is through letting them in, which I think is so powerful.
Yeah, and we really need leadership's buy-in to this whole approach to philanthropy, to major gift fundraising, to any fundraising, relationship fundraising, human-centered fundraising. Because the reason that we as fundraisers, like culturally, we're so obsessed with the ask and getting the dollar goal is because we live on a fiscal year. What have you done for me lately? Right? And again, it's circumstantial. It's not that any, you know, board member or CEO or executive director feels that way authentically. It's just that we are under so much pressure to hit a number, to end the year in the black, not in the red, and to, you know, demonstrate that the community can trust us. We are a well-run organization. And so sometimes we ask low because we think it's an easier ask, and we'll get something on some points on the board.
Yeah.
Or we rush to that ask when we know it would serve the relationship to wait a little longer.
That's really wise. Thank you, Tammy, for sharing that insight. It's very helpful. I have a question for you now, because you've just inspired me in so many ways. And so I think many of our listeners may be thinking, okay, today is the day I'm going to start my major gift program. They are inspired like I am, and they're going to hit the ground running. What do they do first? What do they need to accomplish in their next 90 days? What might that look like practically to start really focusing on this major donor group?
Yeah. So first thing, yay you. That's the first thing, is like commitment and the mindset that we are going to do this, and to make certain that that mindset and that commitment is a long term commitment, right? The consistency. Major gift fundraising is a marathon, not a sprint. So first of all, like really identify and document, why is it important for me to do this now? What difference will a major gift program have for the sustainability of our organization, to ensure ongoing services to whomever we are serving through our mission, whether they're students or patients or readers or helping get more neighbors housed. So what's possible? Because there are those days when you're like, that's it. This board member just approached me with another event fundraising idea. I'm feeling frustrated with my major gift program, getting it momentum. So I'm just gonna do the event. No. Stay the course, and you're going to need your why. Why is a major gift program important? You're going to need that, like where you can see it every single day. So that's the first thing. The second thing is honestly assess where you are. So I would look at my data. Again, this is why it's so important to have a robust, like a database with integrity that you can trust the data, that you is, you know, robust in its reporting, tracking and reporting capabilities. So where are you? How many donors, active donors do you have? What's your 3-year rolling average? What are the segment, how many donors do you have segmented by gift values? How many donors? And I would maybe even map this to the fundraising effectiveness project data. So who are your micro donors, meaning $1 up to $100? Who's $101 up to 500? And so on. Who are my $50,000 plus donors? And look at how many of them do you have? And not only that, but what is your retention year over year? Now, I would say, you know, I'm such a data nerd. I liked you, Julia. And so I would look at like what is my retention for those gift values? Who's and what's the like who's moving up, who's disappearing entirely? Like just tell yourself the truth about what's happening. And then look at even the revenue buckets, meaning how much is coming from foundations versus individuals versus corporations, and understand your year-over-year trends. I would say I would look at a 3-year snapshot. In my heart, I mean, I always loved having a pre-pandemic view, but now, like, here we are. That's like 5 years ago now. So I would say just do 3 years if you can't do five. So see what you see, and then ask yourself this question. Or if you have a team, pull your team together. Ask the team because, you know, different team members are going to have different vantage points. They're going to see different things than you see. So do this as a collective. The other thing is people will be more bought into a plan that they help to create than the top-down plan. Like, here's our plan, go do that. And that's a lesson I learned the hard way also. So assess what is working and what could we scale? What's not working? Maybe it's an event that has a high cost per dollar raised. I mean, best practice has been 50 cents to raise a dollar in an event, but maybe you have an event that you lose money on, or it's 75 cents to raise a dollar, and that's not even factoring in staff time. The point is, look at all of it so you can determine how productive is your major gift pipeline? How could you reallocate resources if you created a stop doing list of things that aren't productive and can't be turned around? Like, just have these honest conversations. And I'm not saying dump the event this year, but maybe we look at can it be reimagined in a way that is more productive? Or could we try two things this year? And if it doesn't, that doesn't turn it around, let's retire it next year. And again, reallocate those resources to our major gift program. Or maybe you'll see that what's not working is that we aren't scaling our monthly giving program. And we know that our monthly givers are the feeder system to our legacy giving program. So again, not just looking at things in silos, but looking at the integration of them, the progression of them. Of course, not every donor is going to progress like we would think, like, oh, they'll be a first-time donor and then a monthly donor and then a mid-level. And then maybe they will, maybe they won't, but some of them will. So look at what the story your data tells you, and then figure out, all right, how does that inform not only my fundraising strategy, but how can that now inform my major gift plan? And the truth is, it sounds like a lot, but there are really just a handful of key data points. You know, the growth in your donor file by segment, the retention in your donor file by segment, and then the upgrade or leveling up in your file by segment. And then just assessing, like, what do you see out of looking at those to inform your strategy? So assess where you are, make a data-informed plan with projections. Like, if you calculate, I want to increase my major gift, but maybe, I mean, first of all, what do you call a major gift at your organization? For some people, it's a $50,000 gift or a $100,000 gift. I've worked with a lot of organizations where a major gift is $1,000. It's all relative to the scale of your fundraising. Now, so see, just begin identifying, you know, if you were to increase your retention by, say, 5% or 10% over the next 12 to 24 months, based on the median gift value of that segment, what kind of revenue would that project? You know, we're so good at making case for support, projections for our foundation applications or even our corporate funding applications. We are not as good about making a case to our own executive leadership about what an investment in fundraising could do, reallocating resources or bringing in additional staff, or maybe just training the next level of our current staff, or bringing in a technology tool, whether it's your CRM or, you know, again, some predictive analytics if your CRM doesn't include that. But again, finding like maybe a technology tool or robust system that's really integrated to help get you to that next level. So assess where you are, make a data-informed plan, make a case for investment or reallocation of resources, and then just start and be consistent. I think that's what I would do in the first 90 days, and it actually is doable if you prioritize it.
Tammy, this is so incredible. I love the fact that you have gone from inspiring and encouraging into this very practical way to get all of this started. It's really a helpful process, and I know that our listeners are going to benefit from it. You're the best. I'm just so grateful that you're having this conversation with us, because it is it's a scary area of fundraising, and I know that you have just broken down a lot of walls for our listeners, and I'm really grateful for that. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate the time that we've spent together and all that we've learned.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect. For more information and a special offer, visit donorperfect.com/podcast.